The year is 1994, and we find ourselves following a wealthy baby named Bink, who was kidnapped by three clumsy criminals posing as photographers. However, the clever baby escapes and embarks on a wild adventure through the city, visiting a zoo and even a construction site, all while the kidnappers are desperately trying to catch him. Unaware of the danger, Bink enjoys his journey, guided by images from his favorite storybook, all the while his parents and police are frantically searching for him. This film blends humor, action, and heartwarming moments, as Baby Bink always seems to be one step ahead of the crooks. Now, despite its simple plot, Baby's Day Out is remembered for its physical comedy, its charming lead, and entertaining chase scenes. It has since garnished a cult popularity as a nostalgic family favorite, especially among audiences who enjoy lighthearted slapstick adventures in literal live-action cartoon settings. This week on Back to the Balcony, we cover Baby's Day Out. Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, two titans of cinematic review. Sometimes right, sometimes wrong, but always captivating. Your hosts Antonio of the Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast and Justin Henson of the Movie Wire are here to take you back to the balcony. And this was like my answer to Cop and a Half, right? Because I had never listened to that Cop and a Half argument before, and it's one of the most famous arguments ever. I had a good friend, Craig McNeil, on my show. He has a Craig and Friends podcast, and usually he does like high-tier artistic cinema, and all he could do off mic was compliment our Cop and a Half episode because he loves it, and he's been trying to get people onto his show to talk about Cop and a Half, and nobody wants to, because it just has that stigma to it. So when I was looking at the most, famous arguments or disagreements between Siskel and Ebert, especially in the 90s, this one popped up. And I remembered seeing this, not in the theater, I think catching it on HBO or something when I was, 13, 14, whenever this movie came out. Saw it once. I kind of got a kick out of it. And then I watched it again maybe 10 years later after becoming a fan of the director, Patrick Reed Johnson, who did the film Angus that we covered, as well as others. And I realized that there's something more to this movie that I feel just didn't hit certain audiences, or most audiences, I would say. So I thought that it would be a good chance for us to revisit it, get your opinion, my opinion, and hear that famous argument between Siskel and Ebert. So we've never talked about this movie. Do you have a history with it?
No, I'm kind of in the same boat as you are. Is I never saw it in theaters. It was kind of one of those that we, when it came out on video, we rented it. And like, I liked it when it first came out. But again, I was, 11, 12, 13, whatever it may be.
And we were too cool for it, right?
Yeah. I mean, teenagers watching a movie about a baby against a trio of villains, you know, it wasn't our cup of tea, but there was a certain appreciation to it. And I've watched it probably about three or four times over the years, not including the rewatch this week. And there is something about this movie that I really did have an attachment to. It's a movie with flaws, but we can almost overlook the flaws just based on the overall filmmaking. And I think that was the missing ingredient on where I've matured, where I can appreciate what Johnson is trying to do with this film. So I like Baby's Day Out, and I don't know if you anticipated me saying that, but it is something that is something for kids of a younger age, but also an appreciation of the visual style as an adult.
I think that's it, because it's a hard sell. Like, what a hard sell of a film. First of all, John Hughes. We've already covered lots of John Hughes on this podcast. We just did Great Outdoors the other day, and I had a comment saying that, like, I feel that he gave his lesser favorite screenplays of his to other directors to do. And Patrick Reed Johnson was this one. Now, there's a very special connection there, because Patrick Reed Johnson has more of an effects background, right? Like, he was a model maker, a special effects artist. So he kind of had like a little of a cool younger person's insight and just kind of grew that into a career. His first film, Space Invaders, which we must cover on this podcast at some point. I'm not going to give any clues to what my thoughts on that film are, But that's definitely a film that 90s kids remember, good or bad. So there is like a very firm footprint of the special effects comedy of the 90s with this guy. And then we talked about Angus, 1995, which is no special effects. It's more of a drama, a teenage comedy. So the choice to do this one, I feel, was an opportunity to make, like I said, a live action cartoon, because that's what this is. We talked about Hudson Hawk being kind of like a Wile E. Coyote Roadrunner cartoon. This is more like the Animaniacs or a Tweety Bird cartoon, Tom and Jerry. There is a very surreal, almost animated quality to this movie when the hijinks happen that the baby is completely oblivious, is in danger. He's just walking around the city, crawling around the city, I should say, while our three bumbling kidnappers are going through, honest to goodness, cartoon pratfalls. I don't know what the audience was for this movie, but now that I go back and watch it, this is an appreciation that they made this, that they made those early CG skylines of Chicago, which are still breathtaking. Watching this downstairs on my big screen TV, I was like, oh, I can't believe how good this movie looks for being just a throwaway comedy from 94.
Well, I think the cartoon element is there. I don't think I appreciated the cartoon element as much as you did, because it reminded me more of a subtle Babe, Pig in the City, where we have the visuals, but it's a lot more pulled back, especially when it comes to the villains, where...
Don't talk bad about Babe, Pig in the City, but no, continue.
No, I am not. I love Babe, Pig in the City, but I'm talking the visuals versus the characters. Yeah. The characters in Babe, Pig in the City are a lot more animated, but the visuals are almost alike in a sense here, where we are engulfed into this world where it's contemporary, but old school, like 50s Chicago. Yeah. So there is a lot in the visual style that we can compare, but the villains, they're mere props to the child. They are just following this kid. And that's where we'll get into some of the flaws, I'm sure. But this is where the villains really do walk a fine line between cartoonish and a serious performance almost, and just have situations just happen to them. So I think what the intent is you can borderline the cartoon aspect of it, but we love the baby too much. And I think his situational pieces and scenes in this movie are more of the entertainment value than our villains just chasing this baby. So I think this is where I had a problem with the main aspect of it, is we throw in the villains as props, but we like this baby too much, and our critics are probably going to talk about it, of we don't really care about the villains. We really don't, because they're solid performances, but we don't know if they're supposed to be slapstick or they're supposed to be serious, because it's an inconsistent antagonist.
They're very one note, and I think that the problem with this movie is that they are given way too much movie to fill, right? And it is a little bit long. They mentioned that in the critique. It is a little bit long for a movie like this. I give it a pass because I'm absorbed by what it's trying to do. But as a first-time viewer or as a critic, I would say this is too long. Just based on the people behind the scenes on this, this almost feels like it should have been an episode of Amazing Stories back in the 80s, right? You know, like a 45, 50-minute long thing with commercial breaks. It seems perfect for that. Like what Brad Bird was doing before he hit it big with animation and feature films. He was doing these little 45, 50-minute long episodes of Amazing Stories. That almost feels like what this should be, especially since it does kind of live in that idea of a live-action cartoon, much like what Roger Rabbit was doing back in 1987. This does kind of feel like a continuation of that. At first, I was offended by one of our critics saying that. But then I had to sit and think about it, and like, well, it kind of is right. Like, the baby doesn't talk. He doesn't smoke cigars. It's not that kind of cartoon. But the pratfalls, the cartoonishness of the violence, and it's violent. This is a violent movie. It's cartoon violence, but it's violent nonetheless. It's like when I go back and watch old Tom and Jerry cartoons, and I was like, oh, Tom essentially commits suicide in every episode, right? In every cartoon short, he shoots himself with a gun. It just turns his face black and everything. But I forgot how serious tones were in those cartoons, and this kind of does the same thing. So let's talk about the villains, because that was a main point of me bringing this to the episode. As we talked about how much we liked the cartoonishness of the villains in Cop and a Half. The Ray Sharkey character was just a perfect kind of slimy sleazeball lounge lizard villain, and his two lackeys, Frank Zivero and the other guy, were perfect complements to that. And I was instantly reminded of Joe Mantegna, of Joe Pants, and of Brian Haley as Vico. These three guys. Now, you nailed it right on the head. Performance-wise, they don't phone this in. They are doing their best work in this. They are giving 100%. We've seen Joe Pants do the slapstick before, like in Goonies and stuff like that, right? But Mantegna, with the exception of maybe Airheads, he's a pretty serious actor from the Mamet School of Acting. So to see him put on these ridiculous disguises and fall off of trucks and fall off construction site cranes, it was a real interesting thing to watch him do that. And I was totally bought in because he was bought in. And I agree with you 100%. One note characters, but the performers behind them were really giving it their everything.
You forgot to mention the record-breaking ball-smashing scene that goes on way too long in this movie, but at the same time, I appreciate Mantegna getting his ball set on fire and smashed over and over again for, I think,
over and over again.
I think it was a minute. I had to time it. I think it was a minute and 35 seconds of ball smashing. So, so he does do a good job, and I think what the intent was, him be the serious one and the other two be the goofy sidekicks that we usually see with villains or Disney villains or whatever it may be. Right. But they wanted to home in on the seriousness of his performance and have bad shit happen to him. So I think this is where the unbalance happens, is the other two side villains don't know what to do or how goofy to go. Nobody wants to outperform the other. And I think that's where this movie really could have been something more to kind of decide where they want to go when it comes to goofiness or where they just want to be that serious element. No, none of the three know what they're doing when it comes to where this movie wants to go. And Johnson, I appreciate the visuals, but I think he needed to actually home in on the talent with his character direction here and say, go all in, because this movie's intent is to be that goofy Home Alone, cartoonish vibe. And there are moments here in the long runtime, as you said, that we don't know what it wants to be or who this movie was made for. So I think there is a confusion, not with the baby, that is clear, but with our villains on where to take this movie. And Johnson, I think, realizes this because he counterfills it with a lot of unique visuals, a lot of eye candy things. I mean, I always go back to the crane with Eddie just hanging from it with the sunset in the background. That's a fantastic shot.
It's and a great shot.
It's a great shot. And it goes for over almost a minute. So there's a lot of visual filler here to compensate for our villains. So I want to say it's a misdirection, but at the same time, it's a smart direction because he realizes where his strengths are. And we don't really get that from somebody that directed Spaced Invaders and Angus. It's one of those that if you're watching it for the first time and you're familiar with the director, it's out of left field on how he directs, because Angus was a low-key film. Space Invaders was just a goofy family comedy with a lower budget. This, he takes full advantage of how this movie looks, knowing that he doesn't want it to be another Home Alone. He doesn't want it to be another goofy family movie. He wants some seriousness to it. And I think that is a double-edged sword where you can appreciate it, but at the same time, it pulls the movie back a little bit.
Well, and also I blame the script more than anything, because this is such a finite subject matter stretched out to an hour 40 minutes. This is an hour 20 minute movie, but it's got an extra 20 minutes of filler in it. Now, if it was just the baby being chased by the kidnappers, I think that energy, honestly, is strong enough to get you through the movie. The problem is we keep getting these intercut segments of the FBI agent, of the detectives, of Laura Flynn Boyle and Glenn Gulia, her husband. I forget the actor's name. But we get too much of these guys breaking up that energy, and I think that's what adds to the length of the movie. When we don't have this constant cartoon energy go all the way through, oh no, we need exposition. I get it. It's hard to direct a story that on script, how long was the script? Because there's not a lot of dialogue in this movie, so it's probably mostly expository action sequences, and then you have to visualize that and then make sets and computer generated components and props and sound effects. The sound effects and music are great. The score is great. Like, there's so much good stuff to this movie. So I think that when seeing the challenge of this film, Patrick Reed Johnson being a visual effects guy is like, okay, well, I'm going to make this movie look as great as possible. Because there's not a lot of story here, guys. There's not a lot of script here. So let's just do what we can to make it visually stunning. And I think that's one of the big things that I miss about the days like this is where, you know, a film like this probably wouldn't get greenlit these days. If it did, it'd be CG all the way. It wouldn't be a live action thing. It would be animated because no one wants to put the time to impress you, because now we are expecting only, let's say, half of the movie's audience to ever see it on the big screen. Most of them are going to see it at home. Most of them are going to see it streaming. So what's the point? This movie looks good on a TV. I can only imagine what it looked like on the big screen back in the day, but not a lot of people saw it. So how are we really going to know? The last thing I have to say about the film before we get into your last thing and then the critics' opinion of it is that, again, this is something that I feel is very 90s. Much like Cop and a Half, much like Kindergarten Cop, there was this real idea of bringing kids into the adult world and adults into the kids' world and kind of blending this violence and action, but also spectacle. And the 90s was a decade to do that. There was some of it in the 80s, but I feel like it was more hit and miss, where this was actually a studio focus. Let's make a film with Burt Reynolds and a kid. Let's make a film with Arnold Schwarzenegger and a bunch of kids. Let's make a film where a baby is chased around by dangerous kidnappers for an hour and 40 minutes. This genre's kind of petered out. And I'm glad it has, because I don't think it's sustainable, especially in today's market. We saw that with films like, what, The Tooth Fairy and the Tooth Fairy and like the Vin Diesel movies, the pacifier, stuff like that, right? That's all parodied now. It's a joke now. And I don't think we're going to see that come back anytime soon. So I'm glad this movie exists. I'm glad that it came out in that era where films like this actually kind of did have an audience, or at least the motivation to find one.
This came out in almost an experimental time of family films, because within the last 2 months of this release, we had like North, Angels in the Outfield, Little Big League, Flintstones. Studios are trying to find the next generation of bringing families into their seats. And this one, out of all of them, was probably the most experimental to an extent, even though it's almost a copycat of Home Alone. But they add a baby to it. So yeah, it's the same repetitive formula that we've seen, but it doesn't go full Home Alone. It's almost like a Milo and Otis if we took out the dialogue, where we're following this baby on a lot of antics that almost pays homage to a lot of those limited dialogue, subtle films of the 70s and 80s, where it is a cartoon at first glance, but it is more of just a visual piece of it, more of just follow these characters, don't necessarily listen to the dialogue piece of it, which is surprising for a John Hughes film, written film, even though we do have a little bit of his heart put into it, but it's a lot more condensed here. But I think this is where the studios really went experimental with it, and it didn't hold up to the blockbuster movies that surrounded it. But I'm glad it has a cult following now, because there is a lot to appreciate about it. There is a lot to appreciate about it now when it comes to overall filmmaking and risk-taking.
Yes, and what it has done is it's encouraged me to kind of go back into the early to mid-90s and think of movies that I remembered enjoying as a kid and haven't revisited them since, but seeing that they have cult followings and going back and digging those up. So yeah, we'll definitely see more films like this on the show. Now, before I get to the critics thing, got to throw this one last little bit out there. I did not know this until I was reading up on it and saw his name in the credits, but Vern Troyer, Mini-Me himself, was the stunt double for Baby Bink. So in those long shots where you see him crawling through the construction yard or across the street and stuff like that, when it's not a puppet or maybe a CG, it's Vern Troyer in a little baby costume going around. So you got to start somewhere.
I love that, because watching it on a big screen now, you notice a little baby hand puppet, but you didn't notice the man adult, if you will,
which is creepy when you see it.
It is super.
Especially in the construction scene when he's like crawling off the beam onto the ground. I was like, okay, that's Vern Troyer. That's a man baby. I never noticed it before. It's crazy. Okay, so now let's hear what our critics have to say, and let's preface this really, really fast. So I could not find the entire conversation about the show. All I could find was an argument at the end. I scoured the internet everywhere, and it shares the same episode as the movie Blown Away, and all I could find was just their conversations at the end debating, not the full review of the movie. But I think that's okay, because it seems like the media stuff is actually in their post-critique argument. So that's what we're going to listen to. It's just one clip. It's about a minute and a half, and Gene was the one that actually brought this to the show.
After The Lion King, I think Baby's Day Out is your kids, little kids, next best choice.
Well, this is fascinating, Gene, because you've just defended this film on exactly the same grounds that I use for The Shadow. No, you like the art direction, you like the look, you like the old-fashioned
and other
feel,
things.
You like the tone. Well, hated this movie more than any other movie on this show, and I'm really surprised at you. You should be ashamed of yourself.
What?
First of all,
for not agreeing with you? I've never been ashamed of that. I've been proud of that.
Okay, well, in that case, here's another star for your lapel.
Okay.
This movie is not funny. It's way too long. The burglars, who are recycled right out of Home Alone, are really awkwardly written, awkwardly played, and they're not funny at all. And the fact, of course, this whole movie is obviously inspired by Baby Herman, the sequence at the beginning of Who Framed Roger Rabbit. It's funny in a cartoon because it's not real. If you think that a real baby crawling through traffic and crawling out on it, look, you're already smiling. You think that's funny. I didn't think it was funny.
I thought it was an absolute perfect child's eye view of the fantasies that they might have. And little kids, this is where I think you're off by a lot, little kids will really have their hearts in their throats as they watch this thing and will be tickled. And will be absolutely tickled by the way the baby survives and the bad guys are
foiled. I think it's a movie that's appropriate for little kids. I can remember three and a half years old, I went to see a movie where Mickey Rooney was standing on a ledge outside a window. It was a comedy. Everybody was laughing. I was terrified. I think a little child who sees this baby about to fall off of tall buildings and be crushed by big cars isn't going to know what's funny.
Oh, you know, I better go back and find out who attended that sneak preview. I saw all those children are in dear jeopardy of becoming
Roger Ebert. We attended the same screening, and those kids were not with that movie.
We didn't attend it. I saw it in Michigan City, Indiana, last Saturday, so you're wrong.
Then, totally different audience.
They're so bitchy to each other. I love it. Okay, so from what I got from that, and from reading the critique of Roger Ebert on his and reading his article review from the paper. So Gene appreciated, and this is so funny to say because it's such a hypocrisy for him. He appreciated the cartoonish danger that this baby was in. And he loved the fact that it was a good-looking movie, the set pieces. He liked the villains. He liked that it was a live-action cartoon. But he loved the fact that there was all these thrilling moments where the baby almost fell off a building or the baby almost got hit by a bus. This is the same dude that will thumbs down any movie that puts a child in danger, saying that it is a cheap trick to pull out heartstrings. It's a cheap trick to get cheap thrills out of people. But he gave Baby's Day Out a thumbs up for all the reasons why he hates other movies that put babies in danger.
Correction, kids in peril, older, but you put a baby under a car, he's all in, thumbs up.
Babies are fine.
So this is where I'm kind of like torn between these two, because in a way they're both right.
And they're both wrong.
And they're both wrong. So, but I have to find a rhyme and reason, because you're right. The one that we would assume to hate this movie, you hated all the Home Alones, we take it down instead of a kid with a air pistol to a baby that's defenseless, and he's defending the same kind of humor that this is going for. So I have to put myself in his shoes on it, and we forget that he is raising a couple of kids at this time now, and whether or not that opened up his heartstrings to see a baby, but I had a problem with a key moment in here where he says kids are going to want to see this baby survive. And that almost loses credibility on the humor of it. Kid wants to see
a baby almost die.
Like, what in the actual fuck? Why would you put that in a critique saying audiences are going to flock to the theater? Kids are going to flock to the theater to see if a baby survives. So I think that's going to kind of lose credibility on who's going to see this movie at the time of this review, because If I heard that as a parent, I'm not taking my kid to this movie, even though with the slapstick humor, we know what the outcome's going to be. It's a, like I said earlier, it's a repetitive formula with a better visual. So I think Ebert said it best, is that the more you like Baby Bink, unfortunately, the less you're likely to enjoy him crawling along a ledge because it almost makes the villains irrelevant. So this is where I kind of agree with him, is I was more concerned with the baby, and I can, if I were to put myself in that theater at that time, I wouldn't like laugh or gasp along with the villains. I would gasp for the baby. You see him hanging from one of those construction metal pillar things, and you're like, oh God, if as a parent, if he's going to turn left one instinct, it's over. So there is more stakes in this movie than a lot of movies, even though we know the outcome. So I think Roger is right in that aspect, is when we do take a child in this kind of peril, it takes away a little bit of the humor. And that's where I think the villains really should have leaned more to the goofiness of it to kind of give us a breath of fresh air, or just kind of make us relax a little bit to say, you know what, I guarantee you things aren't going to be as serious as you take it. So I think that's where the balance comes, where I think they're both right, but like we said, they're both wrong. There's no real in between. You're either going to like this movie and go with it, or you're going to just kind of think it's okay.
Well, I mean, I can't say that it's a hard film to critique because most critics hated it, and that's fine, whatever. We have our own opinion about, like, what does that really mean in the sense of audiences enjoying it? And that's what Rotten Tomatoes has kind of done. You know, a critic score could be 11% and the audience can be 90. It just, things like that happen. I think that Roger, though, is being such a bitchy prude on this episode, because you can't tell me that this man really thinks that a bunch of 3-year-olds are going to go watch this movie and either A, be terrified a baby almost dies, or B, they're going to go crawling out of the theater unattended into traffic. Like, that's the message that he's portraying, and it's bullshit. I don't know. Maybe he was having an off week. He didn't want to put too much thought into it. They talk way too much about this film than they would any other type of movie, and only because Gene liked it. If Gene hated it, it'd be conversation over, thumbs down, let's move on. But sometimes they have conversations like this. Cop in the Half was the exact same thing, where Gene was the prude and Roger was a champ, right? It's just an interesting thing that that paradigm shift happened. I don't like Roger's review of this at all, but like I said, he's not wrong, but he's also not right. The same can be said to Gene about the violence, the cartoonishness, and that's my whole point. Don't look at this like it's a feature film. Look at this, it's like a cartoon. Animate these characters and your whole argument disappears. The only reason why both of their arguments seem to work for them is because it's a live action film. Take the human element out of it, animate it, it's not a problem anymore. You can both hate it. No one cares. It's the fact that it is a live action cartoon and that it's trying to be, that somehow their critic brain can't process the fact that we're supposed to suspend our disbelief and see what they're doing. I think the movie lacks the satire or the self-awareness of itself to make that easy for a lot of audiences, because it plays very one note all the way through. It doesn't wink at you saying we're a cartoon. It just expects you to know it. And I see how some people might get lost in that. But yeah, it's such a weird conversation for them, and it's such a weird take for Roger to have, that this baby is going to cause the mass death and extinction of babies as they walk out of the theater.
This is a movie where the phrase everybody's a critic comes into play, and I'm going to lose a little bit of credibility here, is critiquing a movie like this is stupid. It doesn't matter, because it is going to be a particular taste. It's going to be experience. And I go back to, like I said earlier, Gene just having a couple kids at this point, he might have related to just a baby on screen. Roger, just the other day, I watched a review of Siskel and Ebert on Starkid. And that one is interesting, because it is, if you haven't seen that one, I'm sure that based on that conversation, it's going to end up on the show, because it's a back and forth. You should. But after watching the argument, you probably, because it goes into the debate, is what's more important, critiquing based on your own taste, based on the filmmaking, or based on what the audience feels? So, and that's what this movie is a prime example of, is how you're going to feel as an audience member of what the intent is. Because Roger loves Star Kid. He loved Home Alone 3. Roger didn't have kids. He's taking himself back to his own childhood. If you put a baby in a movie like this, he's not going to reflect on it because he can't relate to it. This is a movie of relatability, of being a father versus not being a father, if I were to go down that route, of family movies. Roger loves to relate himself to where he was as a kid, where his imagination was. And Gene, I think, is putting his imagination in the kid's point of view of fatherhood. So that's where, again, criticism with this movie doesn't matter. It's about relatability and the fun factor of, is your family going to have fun with it? Can you relate to how a baby reacts on screen? Me, and I'm sure you, as a father, can relate to the mannerisms of the baby, the laugh. If you can't smile at the laugh of this kid on screen, you're evil because it's infectious. So I think, again, criticism doesn't matter when it comes to this type of movie because of its pure relatability.
Yeah, it's a good movie, baby. Like, maybe top five movie babies of all time. I would say the little Alora Dannon from Willow is high up there on the list of, like, good movie babies. This one's high up there. I'm not a fan of Oscar from Ghostbusters 2. Not a lot of energy there. Not a lot of personality, right? But this is a good movie baby, Baby Bink. Yeah, okay, I agree. So, like, how do we judge these guys? So, I like this movie. I feel I don't like it as much as Gene seems to like it, which I'm actually pleasantly surprised he does, and I'm impressed by it. And I'm impressed that he stood up for it. However, he is the hypocrite, and we know this, and we talk about that topic very, very broadly on this on this podcast. So, do I forgive him for the hypocrisy and just go along with his review? I don't know. I'm not sure if I want to factor it in there. I think the smart thing for me to do is just to go basis by basis, right? Episode by episode, and just keep it in the framework of that conversation and stop letting his previous hypocrisies and opinions bleed into other ones. Because I'm guilty of that, especially season one. I did a lot of that. I'm trying to look at things at, like, case by case basis. So if this isolated review and conversation comes into play and I forgive all the other hypocrisies of movies that I love that he shit on, I'm going to say that I think this is a solid B from him. I kind of like it.
I think that's fair. And this is where it's going to be tough, especially we've talked about this before. When we enjoy a movie and our critics don't, it's hard to keep bias out of it. But like I said earlier, it's hard to argue with Roger because I see where he's going with it. Do I think he was a lot harsher in opposite to Gene of you really liking the movie? I do. I think he was pretty harsh on it because given Roger, I would expect him to at least appreciate the visuals that he's done in movies past, to appreciate the tone it's trying to do. And is it executed fully to the cartoon extent? No. And I think that's what Roger put himself on. He was hoping for that imagination and he didn't get it. And is it funny? Not as funny as I think Gene made it seem to be. And I think Roger went all in on that. This is a visual family movie, in my opinion, that isn't perfect, but it's enjoyable just by the pure tone of it. And I wish Roger would have gone with that he's done in the past, to at least appreciate the filmmaking aspect of it. So I got to be almost in the middle with it.
Fair.
I got to go 2 stars with him because I can't disagree with him. I do wish that he went further in the filmmaking process, even though I think with critics at this time is a waste of time. They put themselves up on a pedestal to say, this movie is generic, it's silly, I'm not going to waste my time talking about the filmmaking process. And I think that's a huge mistake because there's a lot of good stuff here.
You know, it made me think about, like, how could we fix this movie at all? And as much as I like the three kidnappers and the villains, it makes me think, like, when people complain that things are stereotypical or things are just, like, playing things too hard on the nose of performers or comedy troupes past, there's a reason for that. There's a formula, and the formula works. It's the Three Stooges. It's the Marx Brothers, right? You got the smart one. You got the wisecracking, kind of sly, mischievous one, and you got the dummy, right? You got to have, like, a dynamic like that. And the problem is that all three of these kidnappers are essentially the same level of intelligence and toughness, right? Vico's probably the dumbest, but we only say that because he doesn't talk as much. But they all do dumb shit, right? And they all do kind of smart shit. There's no Groucho, there's no Harpo, and there's no Zeppo, there's no Chico. There's no prominent I'm the smart one, I'm the tough one, I'm the dumb one. They all kind of exist in the same level. And that's why I think hurts the movie, because if you're going to have a trio, they should be very designated in what their role is. And I think that's one of the reasons why we're not invested so much in them, because they're too generic.
I think this movie would have gone a lot further if they stuck with one villain and focused all in on one villain, to be almost like a Roadrunner cartoon, like a Looney Tunes cartoon, to really just have all in on the dialogue and the situational bias of it. So I think they could have gotten a lot of creative, and it would have expanded their minds during this with Hughes' screenwriting process to really say, what am I going to do with two characters to give that cartoonish feel? And I think that's where Roger really kind of is having trouble with the cartoonish aspect of it, of acceptance, because there are too many characters. And I think they're trying, the three characters take up screen time that really go nowhere, versus just make it a damn cartoon. Make it fun. You can still have the tone, but at least just focus on the two characters, and then that would be almost a more memorable villain, because I think the Home Alone villains, that's where we're going to compare it to, because that's where it is. And those are memorable, and it's hard to hold a standard to those two.
It's also where Dennis the Menace got it right and just had one villain and a good one, Christopher Lloyd. So yeah. Yeah, we might have to do that movie too. We might have to do a bunch of early 90s kid movies just to try and prove our point, write our thesis on villainy in kids movies of the early 90s. Anyway, I regress. So, okay, anyway, we are starting our spooky month. This is the last episode of September. We are jumping into October, where we've got a lot of good horror, spooky, violent movies coming out. But the one that we'll be talking about next week, Justin's bringing to the show, we are doing Wes Craven's Scream. That's great. I'm amazed that we haven't done it already, but it is like the perfect movie to talk about it, because it really is a film that reintroduced a whole new generation of people to the slasher film, right? So I don't remember these guys' conversation about it at all. Really looking forward to it. And I'm looking forward to rewatching Scream. I'm never tired of watching Scream.
I think the best part of the conversation, we're going to have to do it later, is Scream 2, because we get into the gene contradiction, and I think that's what sold me on this, is not just the original Scream, but the combination of both of them. And I think it's going to be a great conversation, and I watch Scream once a year. I think it's going to be a good conversation.
Please rate, review, subscribe, give us 5 stars on your favorite podcatcher like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And please subscribe to our YouTube channel. Leave reviews, comments, and suggestions of films that you would like us to talk about, as long as Siskel and Ebert have reviewed them on their show. You can find me, Antonio, over at thecultworthy.com. You can find my co-host, Justin, over at
themoviewire.com.
And we'll see you next week.
See you next week.